Morning, everyone.
Morning, Chris.
Morning, Jason. We'll give everybody a few minutes to get started, and then we'll jump right in. Jason, I know you have a flight. So we'll put the carrier grade and S3P up first.
Sounds good.
Hello.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for joining. We're still collecting everyone. We'll get started in just a minute.
Hey, Chris, this is Steve.
Hi, Steve. Welcome. Well, while we're collecting everyone, let me run through the agenda pretty quickly. First up, we're going to talk about S3P and carrier grade for the Beijing release. Jason's going to kick it off, and then I'll follow up a little bit with the timetable for the architecture team. Then Alex is going to talk about model-driven microservices, and Habib is talking about real-time microservices, so going kind of the same direction. Then Parviz has a presentation about release 2, and as time permits, I'll talk a little bit more about where we are with the architecture white paper and the slide deck. Let's see. Why don't we give people, I still see people joining, so let's give everybody about one more minute and then we'll get started. Okay, so it's 2 minutes after, let's get started. Jason, do you want to kick us off? Jason, you're on mute. Let me unmute you.
Oh, so I'm here. I missed your prompt.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah. Do you want to kick us off with the carrier grade? And some of the activities that are going on that are going to affect the architecture team. And then I'll circle back and talk about some of the architecture timeframes.
Yes. I don't know if the buzz is coming from me or if it's...
It looks like it's... let's see. There we go.
Okay. So I'll pull this up. Let's see. So this is the wiki page for the carrier grade requirements. And I'll just give background. I think a lot of you were in Paris, but for those of you who weren't, kind of setting the stage for what we're trying to do here as far as Beijing goes. I think the mission has, you know, been suggested by the ONAP governing board that we focus in Beijing on things that would help operators of ONAP, you know, take it into production. And so whether you call that carrier grade requirements, whether you call it S3P, you know, whatever you choose to call it, which we may have to have a debate about on its own. You know, the goal is how can we provide guidance and guidelines, if you will, to the project teams on what they ought to do to make each of their components ready so that it could be deployed in a carrier's environment, you know, with the sort of qualities of service that a carrier might expect. And so if you look at things like the general approach here, you know, our goal is not to have a reference ONAP implementation that the community builds that says, if you build it exactly like this, you're going to get 5 nines of availability and you're going to get a certain amount of performance. The discussion in Paris was that that's, you know, that can be very expensive to do. And if the operators want to do that, they're welcome to. What we want to do is just make sure that the software is enabled and ready so that they, you know, that they could do that. And that's sort of driven, you know, the rest of the requirements and the way we've laid them out. So what you see in the wiki is that there's categories of requirements, so performance, stability, resiliency, security, scalability, manageability, and usability. And what we've defined in each of those is different levels of, I don't want to call it conformance, but, you know, building on each other, various levels of that capability. And from a process standpoint, and Chris can give more color to this, but you know, from a process standpoint, we kind of want the TSC to look at these general levels and categories and say, yes, this, you know, takes us down the right route and follows kind of the direction of the governing board for the types of capabilities we'd like to see. And then what we've talked about is the architecture subcommittee, in consultation with the projects, will help define on a per project basis what levels in each category they should meet. And, you know, that could be driven by things, you know, probably the biggest one is, you know, design time versus runtime. So if you have a design time component, you know, doing, you know, some VNF validation up front and it's a one-time process, that probably doesn't have to be as resilient as, say, DCAE or the controllers or something like that, that, you know, is going to be called upon in case of an outage and you want to, you know, ensure that your network service is still up and running. So, you know, taking into consideration those things, where the project's at, you know, kind of their different statuses, all of that will drive some sort of decision, you know, with that project that says, okay, you should meet, you know, level one of performance, level two of resiliency, et cetera, in the Beijing release. Kind of pause about goals and process. Does everybody sort of on board with that?
Was there an attempt to look at things up from an operational versus administrative perspective and look at, you know, whatever the factors are based on that, because it's not just about design and runtime. It's also about what you need from an operational perspective to provide steady state and the level of reliability of those components typically is higher than those that, you know, are definitional by nature. So, for example, defining a policy is something that you can probably live without for a little bit but you know, being able to do closed loop execution of a service instance is probably more critical.
Yeah, right. And so we haven't done any of that yet, right? Any of this assigning of levels to projects. That is, you know, right now we're sort of in the phase of let's get what we think categories are and the levels, and then, you know, this committee working with the projects will help define, you know, who ought to be where. And so definitely what you said, you know, would apply.
Yeah. So from a process perspective, we have to have all this wrapped up by M1. That's when all the project plans have to be in and reviewed. So between now and then, essentially what we're going to be doing on the architecture committee is looking at this framework and starting to figure out what the minimum levels are, if you will, and how we need to be thinking about it. You know, as Jason said, design time versus runtime. If there are other categories that we need to provide guidance to the projects, so that when they write their project plans, they can talk about where they are against each one of these levels, because it is going to be a little bit project specific. Part of the input we're going to take is that Helen is going to come in from the integration team in the next couple of weeks when they have some data, and they're going to share that with us to help figure out where we are today and what we can build on, so that every release can ratchet up a little bit. So we can look at where is ONAP and what's the foundational level, and then how do we encourage each of the projects to move beyond that.
How was this initial list created?
It was in Paris. It was brainstorming, and then the Tiger team starting to pull it together, and then harmonize it a little bit in a way that we can put in different levels.
So there were the two meetings in Paris, and then the wiki page was published, and I sent a note out right after Paris saying, you know, please get your comments in there. We've had actually pretty good participation in the comments section of this, and then we took those comments and did an iteration on this yesterday to incorporate most of the comments that have been put in on the wiki page. But as Chris mentioned, kind of the format of some of these, you'll see, like, performance is a good example. We don't specify specific performance criteria for a couple reasons. One is, you know, what's good, what isn't can be challenging. But also, you know, the environment, again, the environment you run it in can vary, and an operator may have, you know, very high-end equipment or something like that, and very high networking that would influence the overall performance, which isn't necessarily driven by how the software component's written. So what we've written in some of these is, well, let's find out what your performance is under a certain sort of configuration, and then make a plan to do improvements on that, and that's how you sort of move up the levels. And actually, you'll see in resiliency, you know, it's a similar sort of setup. But I don't know, Chris, if we have time or if we want to kind of walk through these just as a preview for the subcommittee. Or
yeah, we have a few more minutes if you do. I know your time is pretty tight with the airlines.
This is Ramke. So one quick question. So in the scope, of course, the ONAP component is very important, but also I was thinking, so should we also be specifying the minimum requirements, you know, for external components such as VNFs, right, or SDN controllers? You know, there are so many to make the whole solution a carrier grade, or is it considered out of scope now?
We've got to start with what we have. I think we have to start with the existing projects under the ONAP scope and look at what's appropriate there. And then if we have to ratchet up to external components and figure out how we communicate those, we can do that in the future.
But from a VNF perspective, I would say that's handled separately by sort of the VNF requirements and the VNF validation program and things like that. And you know, you may, I don't know if they're in there now, but you may see things in VNF requirements to say, okay, if you want to have a, you know, highly available, you know, resilient, performance sort of VNF, these are the things you need to do. That's different than, I think, what the project teams need to build into their software to make the ONAP platform resilient and available, et cetera.
No, exactly. I'm just seeing whether we need to strike that at least the minimum alignment. I'm not saying that, you know, we should do the complete
The two are orthogonal. This is about the platform itself, not the components that get deployed as workloads by the platform. You can argue that a VNF is just a piece of a workload that gets deployed just like a network service. So you cannot, you know, that is much more nebulous because you probably will never be able to enforce it in the first place.
But I think the problem is, though, is like, hey, this is what we're getting from, you know, multi-vendor solutions, how does that whole thing fit in, right? So we go in one direction. So I'm just saying, at least the key one should you be considering, you know, right away.
It's almost the opposite, isn't it? That we don't want the platform to be unstable in case the function is unstable. This, I think, as Alex sort of said, the requirements on the owner platform as such, right? And if we have a badly behaving, you know, network function or controller or external entity, that shouldn't knock out the platform, right?
This is you know, kind of like saying Azure or AWS have certain level of performance and expectations and scalability and whatnot. What they run on top of that platform is irrelevant. It'll behave whichever way it'll behave.
So our focus from now until January, when we hit the M1 milestone, is going to be on the platform and what makes sense for the various projects to help provide some guidelines so that each project can put that into their project plans.
Okay, so I kind of talked about the performance one already. So like I said, on performance, you know, the first level is just identifying what performance criteria are important to that component. So we talked about
some echo coming. I think it's from Ramki's PC.
See if he's still there. I think we might be good now.
There we go. Okay.
So, you know, for example, DMAP or something, its performance criteria might be, you know, messages per second that it handles, whereas, you know, Service Orchestrator or something would be a number of flows that it could run in a certain amount of time, right? So there's performance criteria that are independent by project, so it would be identifying those performance criteria, measuring what they are under a certain configuration. And then for levels 2 and 3, it's, you know, improve on that over a release or you know, to subsequent releases. From a stability standpoint, what we've talked about here, and you know, some of this may still be tweaked, but at level 1 is let's do a soak test, 72-hour soak test of that component. And, you know, what's important, I think it was Vimal that at this point, you know, that you have good coverage in the test transactions that you're sending through in the soak test, because if you're only exercising 20% of it, okay, it's great. There's no problems in that 20%. But in the real world, and you've got much more variable workload, you may run into it. So I think somebody's not on mute. So trying to, you know, find that right mix of test transactions, running steady load over a 72-hour soak test is sort of level 1. And then level 2, this one maybe have to be at a platform level, but we'd like to be able to run those through the components as they interact with each other and see that we've got stability across, you know, multiple components through a similar soak test. And then what we head down is level 3 is more of a defect arrival rate type of criteria that you see lots of times in software reliability engineering, right? And we'll have to figure out exactly how to measure this, but, you know, do we have a lowering of defect arrivals, you know, for code, which means we've got a more stable code base. On the resiliency front, this was called availability, and then we, you know, had a lot of comments about, well, these aren't really availability requirements, more about resiliency. I'm sorry, I don't know if it's Habib or who's kind of not on mute, but we're hearing some background noise.
Try that.
Thanks. So on the resiliency front, you know, the key is if you've got resilient design within your software architecture, then the operator can use that to come up with a highly available deployment. So at a level 1, it would just be some sort of manual you know, failure detection and either rerouting or recovery. What we took out of here from the first draft was any implementation specification at this level. Now, when we get to kind of the next stage, we'll talk about, you know, what common characteristics we might want in the platform to help projects do this. But, you know, at manual level, you've got some way to detect that the component failed. You're able to restart it and get it going again within 30 minutes. At level two, you know, we're saying we're going to need something automated with failure detection and rerouting to, you know, either another cluster instance or however it's set up. And at level two, that would be within a single geographic site. And what we want to do, similar to performance, is gather some baseline information, but in this case, it would be on, you know, failed requests. So if you fail a particular component, and we could have a debate about what types of failures you could have, because there's all kinds of them. But if you fail a component, how many requests do you lose, you know, before the full failover happens in the rerouting? And you want to baseline that sort of in this level two, and then in level three, you'll see you want to kind of improve on it. And for stateful components, they're a little different. What you often might measure there, depending on how you're doing sort of your data clustering, is what sort of data loss might there be if you lose a component. You know, it depends how often you're replicating the data, those sorts of things. So you want to gather measurements here so that you can improve on it. Then for level three, we say, well, we want to do this across multiple sites. And then we want to improve on those metrics that we gathered in level two. Now the longer... I'm sorry, was there a comment?
Yeah, I'm looking at this and I'm sort of worried that we're making the problem 20 times more complicated. Are there any systemic qualities that you guys defined first? I mean, you're essentially setting off each project to handle things on their own, rather, which is not a very cloud-centric way of doing things, right?
So actually, you're a great straight man.
Certainly not a very microservice-centric way of doing things.
So the last comment is that actually what we don't want to have happen is that each project says, oh, I got to go figure out how to do this myself. And everybody's going to come up with their own way to do failover and cluster.
So there are two things, Jason. One is that what do we want from each component will have a different resiliency requirement. But yes. How we implement so that this is the presentation we had the use case subcommittee yesterday to say what are the guidelines for each component can use to implement resiliency in a one consistent way so that people don't invent their own way of implementing resiliency.
Exactly. So
I guess my point is that in a lot of ways, as long as the overall transactional qualities of ONAP are met, i.e. we can do so many instantiation operations, we can sustain operation of so many instances of services at a time for so many customers at a time, things of that nature. Individual components could be as weak or as strong as they need to be. And in the world of the world that I think we're trying to get to, for example, data would probably be handled in a more, you know, systemic way as opposed to, oh, for each microservice or each service or each application that's part of ONAP, how much data loss occurs. Right?
So that's part of what we'll be working on in the architecture committee from now through beginning of January when we have to have something handed off for release one. So these are all good points that we'll be addressing, but we're going to have to work through them somewhat systematically. And this is a great starting point, outlining some of the initial thinking that we can build upon.
Yeah, so that's exactly, Alex, why we've got these comments here about it, and why, you know, as Bimal mentioned, there was a presentation yesterday on some suggestions already on how we put those common capabilities in place, because we want to make it as easy for the project teams to do this as possible. And if they're doing microservices cloud native type development, and we've got underlying platform capabilities to support that, then it should be, you know, almost a no-brainer for them to meet many of these requirements. All right. Next one's here, security. Mostly what we're doing on security is we're basing this off of the CII badging process. I don't know if Stephen's on, but this is at a, you know, the security subcommittee is going to take another look at these requirements and make sure that these are the ones that they would.
Correct. It's on the agenda for our meeting tomorrow, Jason.
Scalability, you'll see it sort of aligns with resiliency anyway, because to be able to do a lot of resilient stuff, you're going to have to be able to scale in and out, independent of other components within a site across geographies. And then what we talked about in level three is, you know, what about scaling multiple ONAP instances and having multiple ONAP instances interoperate, and how would they work together as kind of a grand goal for scalability.
So just so I understand what you guys are saying, so take this particular point, you know, one normally would have a site manager that relocates microservices and reinstantiates them somewhere else, instead of having each individual component do its own thing, right? And also deal with scale and, you know, all of that, right? That's kind of like a cross-cutting operational quality. Is that what you guys have in mind? We're going to build those components next?
I think that's something we have to talk about. You know, this may identify some gaps that need to be filled and potential projects that we want to queue up for the next release.
And how do we make sure that they actually get worked on?
Well, that's the thing. We'd have to find a team that wants to do it, just like everything else. You know, if we put out unfunded mandates, if we say someone has to do this but no one's interested, it's not going to go very far. So this is it's going to be part of the process. If we identify the gap, then we also have to find some people who want to work on it.
Yeah. I'm guessing it might end up as its own project. I think we'll have to see kind of what the recommendation is and, you know, kind of the direction we want to take it.
To that point, I think, Chris, I guess one thing we could do here is, I mean, here are some requirements, right? And then there could be, for some of the projects, a certain common pattern that we might sort of recommend in a way, right? Mm-hmm. And that might fit well into the components that we have. So to the question that Alex raised, maybe it relates to the OOM, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and that's exactly correct. Some of this, you're right. You're absolutely correct. Some of this could be handled by establishing a pattern, and it's like anything else. If you establish it, they have to be takers. But then some of these things, you know, look, everybody's going to go off and start implementing high availability individually, we're going to be in trouble.
No, absolutely not. And that's the part.
And Alex, I think this is a three-step process. What Jason and team did was identify how do we define a career grade? What are some of the character attributes we want? And so you define the attributes. So say then the second step would be to, for Beijing, we want these attributes as a goal. So for scalability, security, manageability, for everyone. So this is our goal for. And then we say, what is the impact on each project to achieve that platform stability? And how do we do that? So those are the four steps I think we need to. What we are describing here is only what are the criteria for defining the career grade. Second step would be, what is the goal for Beijing? We will do level two for security, level three for scalability, whatever are the goals for the platform. Then translate that into each component, what they have to do, and how do we do it in a well-organized way, so that we don't have a completely independent, everybody doing their own resiliency, everybody doing their own way of doing things.
Yep. Just one more point along what you said, Vimal, is that the levels are going to vary per project. You know, for example, exactly. VNF SDK, people might care about security, but aren't going to care about performance or availability because it's not part of the critical path.
That's right. And then same thing with SDC is different than the controller, is different than DCAE. So yep. Everybody.
They will be dependent per project also because of practical reasons that maybe some projects will do better than others.
I think there's a set of throughput criteria that's missing, and I think there's a set of algorithmic sort of improvements that you can make to support a lot of these things that you guys are talking about. But I guess it should all start with the overall system level kind of metrics. Because do I really care if I meet all the criteria at the system level? Do I really care to what extent the performance of individual components needs to be improved?
And also it looks like this notion of site needs to be better clarified, and especially in a distributed data center environment. So especially since a single controller or a cloud instance could be managing multiple sites, I'm not sure this articulates that very well, right? Especially if you go into 5G micro mini data centers. So sort of this still seems to depict the classic data center thinking.
Well, I'd love some input on how we write that to capture what you were talking about. So, you know, please put some comments.
Okay. Out. Yeah, I can.
So,
Jason, one other thing I would suggest, and I'm sorry I didn't provide the feedback early. I missed the whole thread, I guess, that it was happening on the web page as opposed to email. But one thing that figures into all this supported deployment scenarios. They will dictate, by and large, what level of availability, security, scale, and all the other stuff that we need to support. If the certain deployment characteristics or scenarios are out of scope, then we might be, killing ourselves for nothing in some areas.
So let's consider this an iterative process between now and the beginning of January. This is a preview on today's call of work that we're going to be doing on subsequent calls. So definitely keep the feedback coming. We'll work with Jason and the Tiger team to make sure that we stay in sync and that we do have appropriate guidance available for the projects before their M1 milestone.
One aspect as well that's in here in the manageability. It's not only for scaling up, right? It's also for making it easy for someone to download this and try it out themselves to help increase the adoption. Mm-hmm. And that's captured here. It's nothing. It's not that's missing. It's captured here in the manageability.
I think maybe what we should also do in the guidance to the projects is say, okay, here. This is a list of non-functional capabilities or attributes that we expect the components to have, and any project activity that falls into any of these categories should be reviewed by the architecture team to be sure that it's in line with the guidelines.
Mm-hmm. We'll become a huge bottleneck if we do that, unfortunately.
So the TSC is going to review this to some extent when they go through the M1 reviews. What we said is we will circle back at the M3 reviews and just check how everybody did meeting their commitments for the particular release.
And I think Mazin's looking to hopefully recruit whether it's from companies or where else a set of sort of software architects, which would be people that kind of sit in between, if you will, the architecture viewpoints and the implementation at the project level. And that the way I sort of understand it is it would be sort of like consultants, if you will, to the projects on how to implement some of these things and meet those requirements. So we'll see if he can find those people or not, but that's sort of the vision.
Outside the community or within the community?
I think bringing him into the community. I'm just not sure where he's planning on sourcing him from.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I heard in in the last ONF in Paris, I think I heard a call from multiple people to be a little bit more, you know, guiding, more enforcing. Again, not formally, but to me, you know, if we go out to the, you know, to the world with this, everybody will see this list. We want to be sure that projects afterwards, we cannot control what level each project will be at, level 1, 2, 3, 4, because that will depend on, you know, people's actually contributing. But what we don't want, but we want to be consistent within the whole you know, owner. So to me, just being sure that projects do not do stuff that is outside of the guidance, or if it should get in, then we should get it in. If it's something that we've missed,
I think it's a.
Is one of our roles as an architecture subcommittee.
I think it's about setting expectations. If you look at some of the other open source communities of the past that have worked out pretty well, say Linux, there was a fair amount of benevolent dictatorship embedded in terms of, you know, what you could and could not do with certain parts of the platform. And that was accepted by everybody, and everybody felt okay about it, and as a result, things kind of blossomed. There are other projects where this didn't happen, and maybe they're not as successful as they could have been. I think it's a matter of setting the right expectations for this. This is not a, this is a very non-trivial thing we're building, and so certain guidelines and, limitations in terms of how things get done, I would have expected them personally.
Yeah, I think it's both that guidelines as well as, you know, trying to get them on board and, you know, enabling them so that the project teams are comfortable that they can find a way to meet them, because I'm sure some of them will say, I have no idea how I'm going to do this. So yeah, a little bit of both, a little bit of carrot and stick, I think.
It's a continuous improvement process that we can't declare one release as the quality release and that'll be all the quality we need ever. This is a process and we'll get better every release. And this is a framework to make sure that we're moving in that direction.
Jason, I have a question. And I'm going to emphasize the point that Alex has been trying to make, which is that these are the elitis of a typical architecture, right? You impose these quality attributes on the overall performance of the system, regardless of the specific performance of the components, right? And I'm going to argue that some of these characteristics have already been defined. For instance, the decision to use microservices bus imposed a structure on the architecture that defines scalability.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, I don't know if you have done it, but will it be a good exercise to say, well, how many of these attributes have already been established by previous decisions? How many of these attributes are not the responsibility of the projects, rather the responsibility of the architectural design? I believe that's a very good exercise to make so that we do not overwhelm projects that do not have to worry about specific attributes because they do not control them. So I suggest that we take time to go through that exercise because it will narrow down the scope that we need to tackle. Right now, it may sound overwhelming for many projects.
That is part of the input process. I've asked Helen to come back when the integration team is a little further along and they have some data to tell us essentially where the platform is for Amsterdam. And then we can look at that as the input for where can we go for Beijing.
Maybe I was not clear. Has to do with decisions this committee has made or will be making, which is the structure of the architecture.
Yeah, I think putting this on Helen is unfair. Helen is struggling with the integration aspects of the platform but we can certainly do systemic things at the system architecture level that make that and other things that are listed here much more manageable, if not eliminate any need to worry about them
right.
at the project level. That's the point, I guess, that at least a couple of us tried to articulate.
Yeah, I agree with that. When I brought up integration, what I meant was that they're doing some of the system level testing this time around, and they will have some data for us about where things are. So they can come back and we can look, and if you're looking for what the baseline is, we'll get a sense of it from them, and then we can figure out, you know, does this make sense? Are there things that we need to do to significantly improve, you know, metric X or metric Y? You know, essentially, where do things fall down and where do we need more emphasis?
Hey, Chris, this is Parviz.
Yes, Parviz.
Yeah, those levels that we discussed in Paris, is there any acceptable level for any relief? Like, for example, we stop at level 2 or level 1. What is the level of acceptance for each level? Do we know?
That's what we're going to be setting. You know, the task comes to the architecture committee to set the minimum levels for the Beijing release. And let's say, you know, for the sake of argument, that we say level 1, but some projects say they can go to level 2 or level 3 for particular aspects. You know, that's great. They can definitely go beyond and provide greater levels of security or scalability or whatever else, carrier readiness. But we want to make sure that everybody has something appropriate and everybody has a continuous improvement plan already worked into their project plans. So we'll be defining that in the architecture committee over the next couple of months.
And that also brings the microservices aspects, yeah?
Right.
How that would impact those metrics, yeah?
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Great. Anything else for Jason or for today? Okay. Thank you, Jason. And let's definitely keep in touch as we iterate on this. We'll be bringing this topic back to the architecture committee repeatedly over the next couple of months so that we can get to the appropriate level of guidance. You know, again, I want to get roughly a rough draft just after Thanksgiving and then have the final ready by beginning of January.
Yeah, thanks for the input, everybody. That's great. Great discussion. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Next up is Alex to talk about microservices.
All right. Let's see. Can you guys see the presentation?
Yes.
Okay. So hopefully some of what we're going to talk about next will at least attempt to start us down the path of removing some of the issues that we just discussed. What I did is rather than building a new presentation, I decided to build on what we've discussed already. And the first draft of this was published on the architecture subcommittee team, and I hope we can continue to iterate on this and make these things kind of more precise. And so just to recap really quickly, we've talked about personas at some point and, you know, different groupings of folks who interact with ONAP, and this is going to be essential to what I talk about next. And then we talked about different kinds of information we needed to manage and abstraction levels and different information domains and functional domains, and what it all boils down to is kind of the next set of steps. How do we actually translate all this into into a model-driven platform that is easy to compose, easy to use, and easy to extend. So there's some definitions, so when we talk about components in the next few slides, we're really talking about an ONAP functional component, roughly the size of a project, although I suspect to address some of the issues we just discussed, we're going to need to start getting used to having components that are cross-functional and maybe cross-cutting. But anyway, they can be arbitrary complex. You know, you can think of them as, you know, composed of other parts or microservices. It doesn't really matter. Trying to be sort of generic here. Then there's a notion of a provider, and that's a component that takes a particular model object, a particular data object, and implements some set of operations on it. Could be multiple, could be single, could be something that handles multiple different data objects at a time, but that's a provider. And then a consumer, somebody who consumes object attributes, a viewer, if you will, or invokes operations on object, a controller, right? And in the most generic sense you can imagine, you know, borrowing kind of here from the MVC concept of God knows how long ago. And so based on that, I actually dug through the Etsy specs and I found...
do you want questions as we go through this or at the end?
Let's run through this, Steve, and then we can kind of go back and double click on all these things. So I went to the Etsy specifications and actually found an old version of which I think it was, but we talked about the provider consumer pattern and the fact that you know, there was a distinction between different interfaces provided and different implementations, and you can kind of build a component interaction diagram based on this and figure out who consumed what from whom. And from that perspective, you can kind of think of certain components providing resources for other components and, you know, being services at the same time. And this is something that is pretty useful, actually, as we go forward, I think, this pattern in general. So if we were to define interfaces from, you know, based on and the model based on those principles, we'd probably start with user interaction and define a set of actors or personas and user stories and use cases. But ultimately what we want to get to, I think, and this has a lot to do with manageability and just, you know, being able to make sense of how the system is organized. We really want to get to those tasks and different views, right, that different actors or personas might have. And from that, we can derive a set of objects that we manage, a set of managed entities, define a set of operations and attributes on them. And, you know, when you go to a really truly end-driven system, you don't even need operations. But for now, let's say that's what we do, right? And then based on that, you can define the nouns and verbs of your APIs. And in essence, what I'm describing is the basic REST principles that have been used for quite some time, right? You know, you start with a bunch of personas, define the set of outcomes, define what they need to manage and how we want them to be exposed. And this, in essence, becomes your external view, right, of the world. You know, and then you kind of start from there. So one way to do it is to connect that external representation of the system to the actual providers and the consumers in a very systemic way, right? You can start by having an external API and a gateway that sort of, you know, does the security checks and the entitlements and the RBAC operations. But then what you have is some representation of that external model in terms of data objects And then you also have a provider registry. And a provider registry might have in it entries that basically say for what object and for what operation and what attribute a provider is willing to act. And then everything you do by, you know, through the interpretation of the external APIs translates to the object operator. And individual microservices don't speak to each other, but really act upon a common set of objects that they collectively and cooperatively manage. So everything goes through the bus, everything goes through the API router, which routes based on who does what on whom, right? So a couple of things here, right? When we start eliminating the crosstalk between microservices that happen outside of a model like this, you know, the complexities, right? Establish a pretty well-defined set of patterns that are used by each individual microservice or functional component to drive what needs to be driven. There's also this notion of facades that kind of comes into play here as well, and I think most of you guys know what this is about. But I don't necessarily have to build, you know, the providers on the objects from scratch. I can take existing systems and adapt them. As long as the service interface on top essentially acts upon, you know, one or more objects, then we're in good shape. The other point to make here is that you can also make the system extensible by declaring more managed entities that might logically, you know, represent, you know, collections of other entities or intersections or unions of things based on different kinds of properties or whatnot. And again, you can incrementally keep adding content to the system by adding microservices to the bus, right? So in some sense, it can be, you know, very predictable, very repeatable kind of way of doing things. Some benefits here that, you know, we can use this kind of model-driven approach to define what the external interfaces look like by making everything, you know, be operations on these managed entities. This was meant to say ad hoc creation of service interfaces. I can expose interfaces very much like Amazon's, for example, to build up a service instance, you know, one little building block at a time. I can take Tosca templates, for example, also, and translate them into a sequence of object operations, right? I think that's a holy grail for being model-driven at design time anyways, to decompose the use cases into some, you know, sequence of object operations instead of assembly instructions. Right, and then of course, you know, you can operate inside each individual component. You can employ recursively the same pattern, right? For things that are private to you, or even for things that, you know, your the components of your components manage collectively. Ditto for communication between the big moving parts. And for component integration, I've actually used this approach a couple of times, and it works pretty well. It doesn't, a lot of times, doesn't even require any changes to the component. So if some community member wants to bring in a piece of software that, you know, may take time to adapt to our requirements, they can create a facade around it. And make it more compliant with what we want to do through those facades until, you know, they can refactor the code for real, right? The other thing that you get out of all this is that a set of managed object becomes your shared state, right? Everybody has the same consistent view of it. And then they can translate that consistent view into whatever their domain specific representations need to look like. an example of this might be that, you know, if we have some consistent view of a compute resource that has a specific UUID, rather than trying to figure out the UUIDs that might be internal to individual components in terms of monitoring or other things that you need to create instantiation or, you know, dealing with the hypervisors and so on and so forth, you just have one that kind of maps to all the others, right? And individual components can maintain the mappings or do what they need to do, but at least we have one common language to say a compute resource X and mean the same thing every time. That's just an example. And then the last part is the implementation patterns, right? You know, you can start building microservices, you know, as function effectors with consistent operational interfaces. And in a lot of cases, consistent consumption interfaces as well. And that kind of gives you more modularity, more fragment, you know, more fine-grained control over what your components are. And you can imagine that the simpler you make these things, the easier it might be to move them around or reinstantiate them elsewhere or to scale them or something else. So this is not science fiction. I've run at least a couple of projects where we use these kinds of patterns and decent stuff. So you know, I kind of based this on prior experience that I've had. And I think that's about it. Steve, you had some questions?
Yeah, I had a question. When you talked about the provider and firstly, thanks for the presentation. I think there's a lot of good stuff in here. I liked it a lot. There was one part about the provider and the consumer. And so here the provider is not a provider of a service. You explicitly sort of exclude that. The provider is someone that accepts sort of
manipulation of the data object. I am providing a service. I'm manipulating a data object. You know, I have a set of capabilities. I'm refining what we mean by a service here, right? And simplifying it to some extent. You could argue that, you know, providers can be composable and offer increasingly complex services, right? Or capabilities. But, you know, again, at least in part, reducing things down to object operations makes it simple, right? You know, you can define those operations easily, you know, with the critical few that you need to manage things by, and then, you know, for things that have specific functions that are repeatable within the system, like controllers or factories or sensors or monitors, you can also define the configuration.
Were those data objects kind of mapped to like the resources you might see in REST?
Yes, exactly, right? And so if we look at the modeling work that we're doing in the external API project and, you know, what's underlying all that is the desire to create a common information model for ONAP, right? And this does not preclude individual components to have their own internal representations of things for performance sake or availability or whatnot. Nobody's saying that. But building up that notion of shared state, and you know, as you see here, that's the key, right? Because that gives us that sort of consistent way of integration, interoperation, and so on and so forth.
So there'd be also shared state in the inventory in principle, right?
Exactly, right. And so now, and what's really important is consistency of that, right? You know, a lot of times today, I look through the emails and it's about arguing about, you know, what exactly do we mean here? You know, what's you know, how do we keep track of things in a consistent way when we create a VM? You know, I mean, how do we make sure that everyone refers to the same instance? Right, these are the kinds of things you eliminate by having a model like this. Now, the other thing I'll say here is that, you know, ONAP is going to have to become more decentralized, more decoupled, and more kind of maybe regional in terms of operation as we get into the 5G world. And a lot of people would ask, so the shared state, this external model, does it have to be, you know, strongly consistent And it turns out you can define associated localities with some of this data, and some of it you replicate in a very strongly consistent way. Other stuff you just let it catch up as it needs to, right? So you can make this as flexible or as complex as you need to be.
Hey, Alex, this is Murphy. Alex, you mentioned inter versus intra component communications. Could you elaborate on that, please?
So if you use the definitions, today we have a lot of point-to-point communications. I spoke with Helen in Paris about this. Not everyone honors the microservice bus as the carrier of real-time information and communication, right? Or as the means of communication between components. And we do have a fair amount of components in the system that do point-to-point APIs, right? And so that makes it very complicated, you know, to build patterns, right? Because it's much easier to have a truly pluggable environment where you plug things in, you continue to iterate on the development, and at some point when your soup is done, you just enable it. When things call each other directly, you end up with spaghetti. And so what I'm suggesting here is that by applying this kind of data-centric or object-centric approach, different components would essentially invoke operations on the model, you know, when they need to do something, right? That operation may cause a call to a provider, which is another microservice, but everything would be done through operations on objects.
So intra-component communication, intra-component, back to the model that you showed, the picture, where that is exposed. It has to be exposed.
So let me give you an example. Let's say I have a thing called compute resource, and I have a couple of operations, and I should have created this I did this at the last minute. I apologize, but let me try and talk you through an example. Let's say I have a notion of a compute resource. It's an object. Let's say I have two operations, one that says create, the other one that says monitor. And so when I instantiate something, I can have a workflow that first creates something, right? And when the creation is done, that microservice can say, now that I've created it, I'm going to call a monitoring system to actually pass it the ID of whatever it is that I need to monitor, right? And so instead of calling that directly, I could say, I've created it, I'm going to update a UUID on the object. Right, and that may cause a provider of a monitoring operation fire off automatically and use that UUID to now configure a DCAE component to monitor that virtual machine.
So this is all asynchronous, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. Because you can't do this synchronously in the distributed system, right? This avoids locking to some extent as well. We haven't really talked about locking it on that. But that will be a fun discussion. But this kind of, you know, maybe does away with the need for some of it because it is asynchronous.
So, Alex, Avinash, the example that you have given. Sorry, there is some echo. I think Alex, you are on speaker phone.
It's not coming from.
Hello. Yeah, Alex. So the example that you have given, where you are saying that, okay, and a compute resource is being created, then the workflow is adding it to the monitoring. Okay, so there are two steps. Okay, one is creating the compute resource, then adding it to the monitoring resource, and you're saying that this is in workflow. Okay, so are you suggesting that the external API will call the workflow, and then the workflow will decompose, and actually the whole workflow will be called from the external API, and it will decompose, and accordingly it will pass request to monitoring, and then to first to creation, then to monitoring.
You have flexibility, right? So you can do point-to-point calls, or you can send the question through the output. You, and the basic rule is you always invoke an operation on an object.
Why? There is a reason I'm asking. There is a reason I'm asking this. Okay, so if you say the external API, okay, is external API is going to call the workflow. Okay, then the parameter for the instantiation of a compute resource will also include the monitoring parameters. Okay?
So there are a couple of different ways of doing it.
Yes. So if the external API...
One way of doing this would be to say is a business process workflow that gets kicked off for certain external, you know, interfaces. And
hey, Alex, you are fading. Alex?
Can you guys hear me?
Your voice is breaking. Yes, now it was.
It's better now.
Yeah, so, yeah, I have a broken laptop that eventually degrades into nothing here. So, it's a very slow death, believe me. So there are a couple of different ways you could look at this. One, you have a business process workflow that does nothing more than sort of create operations on a one after the next, right?
Yes, right.
And that is actually something that, you know, we may need to do in the future, right, as we get into some of these other advanced use cases with where there's not really a set of just, you know, administrative actions being performed, but higher order business process actions having to do with slice provisioning and other things that may include other steps that are not just object operations. But you can also imagine that if I have pieces, you know, I think the example I gave would maybe apply. So the general pattern again is, you know, I do X on object, I perform operation X on object Y. That may directly cause one or more providers to be fired off based on rules and policies and other things in order to have the end result, right? So that could be done through a workflow or directly.
Yeah, the point I'm trying to say here is that, okay, so overall, if you see the object on which you are operating, okay, is the compute resource on which you are going to operate, okay, and you are operating in two steps. First, you are going to create it, then you are using that creation, okay, to monitor it. You are passing it to the monitoring resource, which is going to monitor it. The point that I'm trying to make is that if that you need to have a continuous flow without any interruption, then at the time of input or invoking that API, you have to pass both the parameters.
Okay? Well, one way to do it, so maybe the example wasn't perfect, forgive me for that, but, you know, again, the idea is that if I update the UID of the object that I created, right?
Yes, right.
Maybe publish an event or do something else that then triggers another provider to establish a monitoring point on that VM.
Exactly. So that was my core point. Thank you very much. So I was trying to say, rather than saying that it is driven through the workflow, okay, what I now understand, and it is exactly the way the JSON, or you can say the RESTful design should be, actually that we will drive the workflow through the event. Okay, so that is good, actually. Now I understand.
So we have the real time microservice streaming bus presentation.
Exactly.
And that's awesome. Do not discount the workflows. If doing something requires me to still dig a ditch somewhere and then do a bunch of stuff, I won't be able to do it through a streaming bus, but I will be able to do it through a Beppel workflow or something else at the high level. But even there, I think what's important is that, again, we're kind of defining a sequence of steps, and we're saying
I agree, because that is a workflow and sequence we need to define. But the thing is that everything, every action or every call is asynchronous, and it is complete on its own. So suppose event is a request is coming in and it is to create a compute resource. It is created. Now, as soon as it is created, a notification event is also created, and there is a consumer defined for the notification event. It could be anything. It could be orchestrator. Then orchestrator is consuming it and then initiating the REX request, that is the monitoring.
So the target of, you know, you can imagine, yes, exactly what you're saying, right? But think of it in terms of the implementation, right? There's something that, you know, I am making a call to update an attribute inside Object X. Somebody's actually going to go do it at some point. And when they're done, they may choose to instantiate an event, right, on some channel inside the bus.
Exactly. So that actually I got it wrong when you explained the monitoring and the subsequent creation and subsequent request of monitoring driven through the workflow. Actually, in order to be in the model, or you can say design principles of RESTful, I think we need to keep it everything asynchronous, and even the workflow need to be driven. It should be driven through the notification so that the calls remain asynchronous with each other.
Yes, that's what business workflows are, right? You know, they rely on some sense of completion before they go to the next step. So anyway, this is kind of, so again, you know, this is to me, again, a useful way to do things. At the same time, I am a little, I feel like in order to go this route, we would need to be a lot more prescriptive about how we do things architecturally.
One thing important actually that I understand, okay, and that is good actually, is that it is every call is complete on its own, okay, and how the workflow is managed, that is outside the scope of the entity model, or you can say the modeling of the API and everything. That is the point that I wanted to mention. So if I am creating a monitor, I'm creating a compute resource, it is a complete request on its own, and the workflow will decide what next to be done, and it will be through notification, not a part of an API call actually. So it is a sequence.
So I think there are a couple of different things, right? So I agree with you that in general things are asynchronous, right? And kind of intent driven. You kind of say, this is what I'd like to do. Then you go away and do it, and then you say, I'm finished, right? And then I can move on. There's some things where we would need to implement synchronous behavior as well.
I agree. That will have a different design principle. I agree. That will have a different design principle.
Yeah, yep. But it's easier to do synchronous on top of asynchronous than the other way around. So,
so Alex, if we... going to the next step on this. So it seems to me that, you know, this is in very general terms, this presentation, we need to kind of ownerize it to make it clear what, you know, what each component is in the ownup world. And
so
if the people from the projects, you know, are going to, you know, need to understand what this means to them and whether some changes in the code or some additions are needed in order to reach this model, then we need to be more specific in, you know.
Well, I agree 1,000%, right? God, you know, I hope you don't think that we can hand this off to somebody and say, go have fun, right? No. I think what we need to do is define, you know, but there are very concrete next steps here, right, which I didn't present on purpose. I wanted to kind of test the waters first. You know, you could imagine that we need to go and define what that logical pattern or that logical model of a service or a component looks like. There's a proposal already in a different community what that might look like and what kind of interfaces it might expose. And I think we discussed it in one of the modeling meetings already. And if we use some of these patterns, you know, they're very concrete. They exist, right? We can actually go and pick the ones we want and then go with it, right?
One question there as well, because in order for this to work, it requires tooling.
Yes, it does.
So hold your thoughts a little bit on that, because we have a presentation that's coming up that'll talk a little bit about some of that. But yeah, you're right. And then I think we need to, if this is an approach that the community is really interested in, we're going to need to roll this into the target architecture, share that with the rest of the community, and then figure out what steps we can take in the R2 timeframe to move to this vision.
Yeah.
Okay, because the tooling question relates a little bit to Tuppy and Miff and what they've been doing and the external API project. Where,
yes, exactly, right?
Okay, so that hooks in with that is what you're saying.
It does, yeah. I didn't want to sway things into any particular direction, but yeah, I mean, there have been so many attempts to do this, and it's been, I think we can have a choice of what we want. Meth also, I believe, has something on this one too.
Yes.
Well, right. Hey, Alex, for ONAP, a specific the previous question, the operation that today, for at least for release one, we have the tools like directed graph. I guess it's based on Node-RED, the IBM tool. Is this microservices going to really change the behavior of the workflow or based on directed graph? Do you have any?
The attempt is to, yes, I mean, the attempt is to really flatten this out. Somebody's, Ramki, can you please mute your line? There we go. Yeah, so the attempt is to flatten things out so that you can have more of a plug-and-play environment and then superimpose layers of workflows, synchronous and not, on top of it, right? But, you know, what I was hoping we could get to, you know, from a vision perspective, is a world where projects could proceed asynchronously and expose a set of touch points to the bus, right? And then whether or not we enable or disable something is entirely based on some criteria in any given release. But at least you can work without having to rely on any point-to-point communication. At least you can kind of establish your own kind of set of objects that you operate against, and when you're ready to release your functionality, then you expose those. Now you can have other components kind of go in and start consuming them or augmenting them and doing what you need to do. But I you know, what this does in some sense also is simplifies testing. I was talking, I'm at the, in The Hague this week. There's a company here, and you guys probably know these guys. Viavi is the name of the company. And they do microservice testing. And, you know, the system that they use is so simple. I compared it to what, you know, we did for release one and are doing for release one. And it's like, you know, I don't want to over-exaggerate, but we're playing with stone tools, and those guys just plug in their test framework into the bus and start throwing messages, you know, around the single microservice and put it under stress. And when they instant it works okay, they do it to the next one and the next one and the next one, right? It's so pluggable, you know, and here, you know, we spend hours and hours trying to integrate each component with every other component.
My interpretation of the question was, does this change the directed graph and so on like that? I would have said no, because this is about the communication between the services.
The directed graph from what perspective?
In the perspective of, well, I was taking it in the perspective that APSI internally uses that in order to sort of decide how to fulfill the request.
Yes, I misunderstood what you guys were talking about. Yes, I mean, the internal representations are going to be graphs. They're going to be directly, right? How we represent some of the notions of the known app is not likely to change. But
yeah, exactly.
But what it does force us to do, right, is to, again, go back to the use cases and say, what are the Lego blocks that construct a particular instantiation of the use case? And then those Lego blocks can be arranged in a graph. But now you have a systemic way of impacting each one of the Lego blocks.
And I was wondering, would it be worth teasing this out with some examples, concrete examples? You pick certain one-app components and see, you know, sort of before and after effect, right? So here is how it is, and here is how it's going to change. In fact, in multi-cloud, we are certainly thinking of these ideas in the data management framework, especially communicating data asynchronously at scale, right?
Yeah, so if I look at what you guys are doing, since you spoke about it, I kind of see a collection of factories, right, that know how to construct different kinds of resources. And so there could be a hierarchy of factories, it could be a single factory, but it's, again, you know, from an external perspective, all I really want to be able to do is create an instance of X. If that translates into a call to a factory that says, create me a VMware VM versus some other VM versus something from Azure versus Amazon, you know, again, this principle would apply pretty well. But what it also does is allows you the ability to create providers for different resources in parallel, right? You no longer have to have additional abstraction layers. You can have routing policies and brokering policies that route your API calls appropriately by examining the parameters on the fly. So in some sense, maybe it becomes simpler.
Alex, one comment. This is Manoj.
Yes, sir.
So if I look at this diagram that you have shown here, so you are suggesting that we should have a centralized registry which will maintain a data tree of objects, and each service will operate on those objects to replicate interaction between those services. Is that a right understanding?
There's a registry. It may not be centralized, may be distributed, but yes, there is a registry, yes.
So I see some similarities to the way OpenDaylight has implemented this. I'm not sure whether this the reference you have used is OpenDaylight.
No.
So there a similar mechanism is used where MDSAL maintains a central registry of objects, the data tree. And in addition to what you have shown here, there are framework components which will manage the objects and also provide capabilities like RPC interaction and notifications. So maybe this registry has to be enhanced with some additional framework components, but I see some similarities with OpenDaylight, the way they have implemented MDSAL.
I mean, you can look at a lot of cloud systems similar kind of default registry, right? And this is not unique to anyone. I'm not surprised. I did not look at MDSAL, but you know, there are plenty of other projects, commercial and open source, that use this kind of approach. So it's not uncommon to do what you suggest.
Yeah,
you know,
I was just suggesting that maybe the next step, if you are looking for, maybe you can refer to OpenDaylight, which
we could.
So let's do one final question, because we got one more presentation that I think dovetails with this, and I want to make sure we give time for Habib as well. Last question.
I just have a comment, actually, which is a mistake many projects make, which is to reinvent the wheel. Within OpenDaylight, we had a discussion about using a kind of off-the-shelf component to replace MDSAL. MDSAL is a custom-made solution for a service bus. So keeping in mind that there are solutions out there that we could reuse is a very important
aspect. So that's key, right? So I look at the Netflix open source framework that they released. It operates at scale, level of scale that, you know, probably goes beyond what we can do right now. It's cloud ready, it's cloud centric. I look at some of the stuff that Facebook and Google have released. Yes, we should try to borrow open source components where we can, but let's also kind of make them, you know, I guess I would say let's make sure we pick something that can scale out to levels beyond what is required today, right? And we can look at, you know, we can be inspired by what happens in the enterprise world as well as in the telecommunications. But I agree, reinventing wheels is not necessary here. Plenty of things have come before us and done this.
Okay. Well, thank you. And Alex, thank you for the presentation. I think this was a good discussion. Let's pass this over to Habib now.
Yeah, let me stop sharing here. There we go.
Okay, Habib?
I assume it's uploaded as well, right?
Is it?
Oh. Hey, Chris. Sorry, yeah. Just pass me.
Just click share the screen in the middle of your screen.
Okay. Give me one sec. Yeah, let me know when you guys see the presentation.
Looks like it's behind your Zoom window.
Hold on. Yeah, I'm trying to figure this out.
Okay, now I see it.
Okay, is that, can everyone see it?
Yes.
Okay. So, the ideas presented by Alex, right? This actually just resonates a lot of the core messaging that he has. I mean, although I've never actually talked to Alex before, but I don't know. I have a lot of material to cover, so I'll cover that, and then we'll have some questions towards the end, maybe, right? So the idea behind this presentation is more implementation centric, although it does revolve around requirements that I noticed as gaps that we need to address within our own app framework. And it fits in as a complementary solution. So keep that in mind, okay? So what are we trying to address? We're trying to provide a real-time data event streaming and processing fabric that also enables us to have a geo-distributed synchronized event DB, okay? Some of the points that I'll cover are the backgrounds and challenges, proposed solution architecture, where ONAP is impacted, how it's impacted, and how, where this solution or this framework would fit in, use cases, how it affects geo-distributed tier deployment, and then deep dive into comparison of streaming and DB technologies for an app. Touch on model-based approach, which is actually the core of this idea that it is leading to a model-based, data-centric deployment approach. So the reason I call it deployment is it actually extends beyond architecture design into implementation and deployment, okay? So what are the points I want to address, right? One of the key ones I've tried to capture here, that we need a flexible, scalable, and reliable path to microservices-based model-driven architecture, right? And listening to Alex, it's just, I think it's the same concept that I'm trying to address, but this goes more into tooling as well, this presentation. So we want to be able to handle models very flexibly, right? So your implementation or your tooling system should be able to address that capability. Now, the architecture needs a way of dynamically plug and play a reliable, real-time, flexible event data pub-sub-based streaming fabric, right? So it's more than just a bus. It should be a middleware, right? And some of the tools that I'm presenting as a solution address that, right? So what are we trying to achieve? We want to be able to handle heterogeneous nature of vendor products, north-south interconnectivity between management and operations, have even flexibility for handling control and data planes. It stitch together a data-driven model to tie the services from control, management, and operations. So that's the key, right? We need to have a way to stitch together seamlessly all these different facets of network systems and beyond, right? Facilitate an asynchronous pub-sub architecture for microservices. So this is the key. So we want a loosely coupled asynchronous pub-sub architecture for microservices, and this solution provides a mechanism for that. Another key thing is to allow and facilitate geo-distributed edge-based intelligent processing. As we're noticing that the edge below the data is growing by leaps and bounds, right? So we need to be able to process this data in real time, and we need to be able to preserve this data as it floats across a geo-distributed system, hence preserving the state, right, of the network as it flows through from one entity to another. So we achieve this through this core middleware that I'm suggesting that provides a synchronizable pub-sub-based DB, end-to-end DB. Now, it allows us to achieve a seamless model-driven approach and facilitate both a microservices stateless and a stateful architecture, right? I do mention stateful, but that is for handling some of these offshoot cases. But obviously we can't get away from that, right? So these are the core principles that I wanted to address. Now, where are we currently, right? Our current system as an ONAP is fragmented between APIs and PubSub, right? You have your endpoint, which are your publishers or providers. They interact with APIs, and it's actually pushed over to some bus, and then eventually it connects through a message server, then the consumers consume, right? What we want to achieve is a bottom-up modeled approach where you see these colored objects that I'm pointing at right here. They represent a upfront modeled view of your endpoint or your provider endpoints or your publishers, right? Now, they are connected through a streaming pub-sub mechanism through a aggregation and processing and transformation component, and then actually further gets pushed to consumers, right? So all this from bottom up needs to be a declarative model-based approach that needs to be handled in a real-time way, but the real-time aspect of it needs to be very detailed. It needs to be able to be reliable from the provider endpoint to the consumer till it gets to it. So that whole path needs to be traceable and achievable in a very consistent way. Okay, so what are we trying to achieve, right? I do a comparison here between the microservice bus, the DMAP, and the real-time pipeline, which I'm proposing here. it's a complementing solution. In essence, what we end up having is a real-time model-driven data stream that comes up. We collect specific data, which is again a model, initially model-driven. So there is no chatter, right? So what I mean by specific is it needs to be not a pollution of data space. It needs to be a very well-defined data model-oriented specific data stream that needs to be pushed up, right? Then we need to be able to, once we push this upstream to a consumer pipeline, we need to be able to query, filter, and create all sorts of relationships, intersection, or complementing scenarios in the pipeline mechanism itself, right? And this needs to be guaranteed. The sequence needs to be guaranteed of this data as well, so that we have a consistent and sane view of this data end to end in the distributed network. We need to be able to perform and handle huge data streams and basically perform the ETL function, which is the transformation function of more aggregation and putting it together so that we have upstream data to be more specific and not pollute the upstream space, right? And then further, it needs to be pushed to consumer on-app applications, right? So what do we end up getting? We get a real-time flow, make the stream and the processing intelligent this way, right? So what we have is currently a microservices bus that's already there, right? There's a lot of API-centric operations. These tend to have caused tight coupling. What we need to have is a loosely coupled pub-sub asynchronous mechanism that provides this interconnectivity, right? If you look at microservices, some implementations use JMS. JMS is very specific to being on the Java-centric, and we need to be able to have a more of a polyglot type of approach, and it needs to be light. Cannot connection-oriented, it needs to be connectionless, but at the same time provide you reliability, right? And this, further, another important point I want to make out is the data that's being exchanged needs to be very efficient and binary in nature. We want to limit the usage of JSON-based payload where there's a lot of text translation that needs to happen for both on the serialization and the deserialization part of it, right? The other key aspect is there's no synchronization capability as such. We need to be able to handle that end-to-end where we have these logical objects that basically are, think of them as floating in the network, although you design them upfront, and they are self-synchronizing. If a change happens, we basically have that change pushed to the subscribers on the consumers. And then from there, the consumers have a model that triggers, that causes them to go through certain actions and further push out another event, right? So creating more of a declarative, this is how I want to be, a approach, right? We want to reduce more tight coupling. We want to be able to have not be able to have a client server or a TCP or a connection-oriented type of approach. We want to be able to have a loose asynchronous approach, but at the same time, we want to provide a wire level protocol guarantee that our end-to-end communication for these data objects is reliable, right? And further, so once we have this stream, a pub-sub stream established, we want to be able to handle that it concurrent, handle the stream concurrently, non-blocking way. There's back pressure handling end-to-end in the pipeline. So this is another key thing, right? When we see designs, we just focus on some parts of it. Okay, yeah, great. We create a pub-sub mechanism, but we don't think about how do we extend that pub-sub into the actual processing so that if you have a huge influx of data, we need to be able to handle it without getting blocked, and we should have clear back pressure handling in a concurrent way, okay? So these are the key things, right? Now, we want to be able to introduce this in a complementing way. So the idea presented here is actually proposing a complementing core service within the ONAP or our architecture, and I'll touch into that in detail. Okay. So what are the building blocks? So I want to do describe the tooling right up front, and what I call this proposal is a real-time data event streaming and processing.
A quick question on the previous slide, if I may. This is Ram. A quick question.
Sure, hold on. Yeah.
So on the second point on the PubSub, right now the Kafka is definitely capable of a lazy replicated model, right? So are you saying that it's more of exposing such capabilities, leveraging such capabilities, just to clarify? Right, I mean, DMAP is based on Kafka, which provides...
No. So I have in-depth discussion of what Kafka can cover. We'll come back to that. So let's hold off on the questions and what Kafka can provide and what Kafka cannot provide, right? And I'll come back to that.
Habib, I think there is a point to say that to say Kafka is centralized is not a true statement. We distribute Kafka.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at, yeah. So...
Yes, the, not real-time is also not a true statement to say Kafka is not real-time.
No, I didn't say that actually. There's real time, the meaning of real time is different, right? So I didn't say that it's not real time. Right? The idea is that let's walk through this.
Okay.
And then come back because there are two open questions, right? You're discussing about Kafka, and I'm not replacing Kafka, by the way, right? And also the real time nature of it, right? We want to be able to handle, and I covered this topic later, and the magnitude of what real time is. Are we talking about less than less than, in the order of milliseconds or less than milliseconds even, right? So that's what I'm trying to address, especially when you have huge influx of data. Anyway, let me cover this, the building blocks for pipeline. The core for the this proposal is around a data distribution bus, or I would also call it a middleware, because it does much more than just a pub-sub pipeline, right? It provides you not only peer-to-peer, but it also provides you a brokered approach that to interconnectivity. The way it provides reliability is it has its own feature set of quality of service, which is it's a set of features, about 20 plus features, which actually allow the event to be tracked in a very fine grain way, so that you have a lot of knobs to handle the end-to-end delivery of the event stream. It's asynchronous in nature, but it supports synchronous. It's time series and data history. The thing that I was trying to point out earlier was that we want to be strongly typed, right? And that's one of the key differentiators, right? You often define a data-centric model of your PubSub, all right? So you define these objects through your IDL, which is structured, right? And it could be having different implementations. It could be protobuf, or it could be DDS's own IDL, right? It provides natively discovery, query, and filter mechanism. It is connectionless and is optimized. It provides you a publisher-consumer model. Up front, you need to define a relationship, and this relationship allows you to basically tie the data to a services model, right? And it reduces chatter by upfront clearly defining a data model. So the whole idea here is that it's purely data-centric, which ties to the end, eventually consistent data, data-driven a DB or a cache, right, which connects end-to-end different components. Now, as you go along this pipeline, once you establish this pipeline, you need to be able to process, collect and process the stream in a very real-time and a reliable way. So I mentioned some of these tool sets here already, APA plus Kafka for collection, right? This is an aggregation. And then this pipeline further goes into a real-time transformation capability, right? Through Beam, which allows you to handle streaming and batch processing together, right? I'm going to put these slides up on the wiki so folks can review that later and consume it. Now, so the idea is that you need to be able to have this PubSub model that also provides you this NDB capability. So every event that comes in is actually a data object that ends up in the end consumer, and its consumer basically has a cache of all these state changes that are happening in the system as events, so that it can actually do query and filter operations on them as well. And this is not for huge scale. It's for actually a pipeline type of processing where you have your cache and it has this query mechanism, and it allows you to be able to have a consistent view, but it can also offload any type of this event to a back-end database. Okay?
Habib, can I ask a couple of questions on this? We seem to be lumping together a few things here that might be better to tease apart, right? There's an issue we have where we kind of need to build a real microservice interconnect or a backplane, right? Not just the bus. Mm-hmm.
And we needed
to have different channels with varying degrees of reliability and so on, yes, and guaranteed delivery and all that. That's one thing. And we need a data polyglot layer and a data abstraction layer, so, and a reliable and a consistent way of replicating data around. That we do need. And then we, yes, also need some way to query all the data, right, in a distributed way, right? Yeah. You know, to me, those are separate pieces. It's a tool chain that you're describing. But I guess my question is this. At the core of this, are you talking about something that has dumb pipes and smart endpoints, or are you actually building a lot of smarts into the pipes themselves from the communication perspective?
Communication pipe itself.
Just the basic,
right,
pipe.
So the pipe itself is becoming smarter, and then the pipe makes the endpoint where it terminates smarter as well. So two parts of it. So the pipe itself is smarter because it's Right. It's just a termination point, right? So you have, let me actually continue through this, right? And then I know there's a lot of material to be covered here because there's a lot of aspects that need to be touched on. So, but you are right. It's the pipe itself, the streaming pipe that is smarter. And then where it touches the boundary of the consumer or the provider itself, that needs to be handled too. And that's a very important point that you brought up, that otherwise you don't have this consistent view from beyond the pipe into the actual application, right? And that's what we're trying to close the gap in, at least in this proposal.
So another question here, so on the previous slide, are we talking about a specific type of database for all types of data, or what does this really mean, the DB persistent, DDS cache? What is it storing actually?
So, yes. So it is storing actually a model event that is being originated from, let me actually go through, let me walk through this, okay? I know, let's hold off on the questions. Let me actually cover some of the key slides and then I'll come back to this, right? So there's a Kafka question and there's this exact question where about the pipe and how the endpoints are smart, right? Let me just touch on where this would fit in, right? This is where it fits into the overall ONAP architecture. It is going to be a common service, and where you see the purple circles are basically an embedded library that is on consumption, can receive this stream bus, right, endpoints. And it's, again, it's basically has hooks into the design time, some resources, because they all would be used to facilitate end-to-end from endpoint up to the consumers, which can be controllers or whatsoever, right? The pipeline. So this is what it looks like, right? From a proposal perspective, you have your end, let's say VNF. They would have some kind, like for example, a load balancer, right? It would be generating some kind of event stream based on this library, right? And this event stream is basically representative of that particular VNF services, like the number of server farms and the number of connections being handled, and so on and so on, right? And that stream will be handled by this real-time processing engine. And this real-time processing engine would process this particular huge influx of data to its end consumers, right? Like a DCA, homes, and clients, right? So the idea here is that this will provide you a generic transformation capability of this huge stream. And this huge stream actually basically just gets simplified to the end consumer's needs. That's the goal, right? And then it could be purely a data model driven approach that is upfront defined here and gets pushed all the way in as a closed loop action that at the end take some corrective action. Now, the question was that what kind of data are we talking about? So this data could be a different model layers, right? It could be the configuration data, it could be the real-time operations data, it could be actually any kind of data that can be modeled up upfront. And then as the changes happen, these changes are automatically pushed by these southbound entities up to a centralized call. So does that answer the one question about what kind of data it was?
But I think the question was more about a one-size-fits-all database versus a polyglot scheme where you have different
Databases. So the polyglot is more to address. So the idea is that you have one language or many languages, right? You can have Java or Python or so on, right? So you can create a data model, and the DDS technology allows you to create bindings in any of these other type of languages, so that you don't have to worry about your serialization and deserialization, right? In essence, you can be receiving the data here, and this data is stored as samples, and then the application itself can just pull out that model data. So it could be as simple as an C++ object, or it could be a Java object, or it could be a Python object, right? So it actually provides you an object interface all the way from here, from the VNF to the end consumer. Okay.
Habib, I think the biggest challenge in my view is you are putting this agent on VNF, you are modifying VNF, and I don't know how many vendors are willing to say, yeah, you go ahead and you deploy your agent, and what other changes are needed in the VNF itself for it to publish that in DDS format. I don't know how pragmatic that is, really, to say we have hundreds and hundreds of VNF, modifying those VNF to say, now you will publish your information in this DDS format.
Right, so it's not the DDS format, right? So DDS has nothing to do with the format, right? You define your data model.
But you're putting an agent there, and that's to me, at least to me, it sounds like a very big challenge to say, we don't have that much control on VNFs. And we are saying that we are going to put a piece of code, whether it's called a DDS, you call anything you want,
yeah,
a piece of code, and I don't know how practical that is.
But it's not, you can look at this as a thin proxy layer around the VNF if you want. The VNFs will have different styles of delivering information at the state, right? You can consume it and transform it, right? There's no need to put stuff on board the VNF, per se, right?
And
right now,
he's
showing that there is a piece of code that sit on the VNF, and that's where I think I have some.
And I agree with you. Right. It won't work if it's embedded.
Yeah. And in my mind, I think several questions need to be answered. Like, you know, how does UDP? I mean, UDP looks beneficial on the surface, but you really need to drill deeper on, you know, packet loss, and I mean. TCP has solved so many of those problems these days.
TCP is very connection oriented, right? So that is always, you're relying on native TCP for your real time pub sub needs. I think that's like too much of an overkill on the system.
I know. Can we present some? Do we have any concrete data to support it? Because even TCP now is optimized like hell, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
So I think there is a contradiction term. If you want reliability, but we want UDP. To me, that those two terms don't go together.
UDP is there for connection oriented. This mechanism also supports TCP approach as well. So UDP, and then there's as I mentioned, there's a wire protocol which actually provides you, although it's connectionless, but it provides you guaranteed way of making sure that your end-to-end stream has sequence, even the sequencing is guaranteed, right? So what this slide is actually showing is actually you have all these, there was a question about the data, right? So all the streams that come up from the network are stored as data samples, right? And these data samples are actually are basically, in essence, objects that are defined upfront. You can provide, and this part, application part, is separate from the actual network facing part of the underlying wire protocol, right? So till here is your connectionless UDP-based approach, which can also, you can use TCP in this case. But the preferred way in this scenario is UDP and then use the wire protocol. Now it allows you to not only push this event stream up or sideways, east west, but it also allows you to synchronize them consistently, eventually consistent. So you can have like scenarios where you have non-deterministic link, or even in good scenario, of course, you have a deterministic link, and then you have deterministic link with failures. So what you need to be able to handle, how would you handle that, right? Right, that'd be great. If you have TCP, right, if the connection breaks, how do you know that you can synchronize the two endpoints, right? So with this middleware, you can actually, it has a built-in capability that the data will, if you're a subscriber of a particular type of object or data, right, it will receive it, and then it will provide you traceability by logging that this data has been received, right? So you can actually track each sample of the stream that comes up. You can actually set up filters and queries natively within this application. Now, the point about many vendors, how do we homogenize this? This is a very light agent-based approach, which can also be introduced as a proxy, right? So you can have a proxy up top that can also handle southbound native communication and push it up through this interface, so that it kind of homogenizes your heterogeneous southbound interconnectivity, exactly to the point of why, hey, we have many VNFs and they have their own implementation southbound. Right, so I mean, if you are going to pull everything from APIs centric southbound, then that is the bottleneck, right? You need to be
I think you are putting words in somebody's mouth, because nobody said API. We are receiving asynchronously events. We are receiving asynchronously streaming data.
How would you do that? Allows you to
SNMP.
Yes, SNMP is typical, right? Yeah, SNMP has been around for longest time. It's very static, right? It's the pull, you have to configure it all, and then you have to be able to be dependent on this MIB-based approach. What this is,
I'm just giving one example, but I'm saying that
sorry, just a before we go on, just a quick time check. We're at the top of the hour. Do people have maybe an extra 15 minutes to wrap this up, or do we need to have a hard stop now and move it to next week?
I can.
I would prefer a hard stop, because there are several questions, and also we are looking for data, right? So basically, data and comparison data between TCP and UDP, and perhaps how this is different on Kafka. I'm assuming this will be a bigger discussion. That is my two cents.
I agree.
Okay. I assume it's going to be posted, Chris.
Yes. Habib, have you already posted it, or do you need my help with that?
No, I'm going to post it.
Okay.
I wanted to see what the people had to say.
Oh, okay, great.
I'm going to post it right after this call.
So why don't we wrap this up now, and we can pick this up. Habib, we'll put you on one of the upcoming calls next week or the week after.
I think we need to get to the art to architecture, because I think these are interesting topics, but I think we need to focus
on that.
Yeah, that's queued up for first thing on the next call. Parviz has the first slot.
Parviz, okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, bye.
Great. Thank you, everybody.
Everybody.
Any final comments from anyone? And then we'll break the call and pick up again next week.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye. Thanks. Bye.